From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On the program today, we hear about a grounded cargo ship that shut down the Soo locks. No traffic in or out of Lake Superior.
We do understand that the economic impact is very important for us to get the waterway open as soon as possible and let commerce flowing through.
A Bridge Magazine reporter tells how the government used to enforce segregation in neighborhood housing.
Infiltration: Jews and Negroes, Greeks and Syrians, the foreign-born, Italians, Poles.
We'll hear from those against the development of a Lake Michigan dune area, and we'll hear from the developer.
We were able to basically identify all the areas that we should just kind of stay out of.
And our latest artisan of Michigan describes her product.
And it goes over one shoulder and holds your baby like on your chest or on your hip.
There's a lot more happening there than simply making baby carriers. Before we get to that, let's get the news update. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On today's program, we'll hear opposing views on a potential development of a stretch of dunes near Saugatuck. And later in the hour, we'll have an in-depth look at redlining in Michigan and its costs. But first, yesterday, the federal court heard testimony in a lawsuit against the state by seven Detroit school children. Michigan Radio Sarah Swick was there, and she joins us now. So, Sarah, what's this case about?
Well, this is among a cluster of cases that are known as so-called right-to-read cases. And the basic core question here is, does the state of Michigan in this case have an obligation to provide a basic, minimally adequate education to school children? So is that a fundamental constitutional right to receive at least a basic level of education? And the plaintiffs in this case say they are not getting any kind of education. They cite a whole list of problems, including a lack of teachers and classrooms, lack of textbooks, terrible conditions in the schools with vermin and all sorts of hot and cold temperatures. And that's basically what the case is about.
What happened in court yesterday?
So the state is looking to have this case dismissed, and they made a motion to get it dismissed. So basically, both sides were laying out their argument to Judge Stephen Murphy for why this case shouldn't be tossed out at this time. And there seems to be some agreement that the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that there is no fundamental constitutional right to an education. But because education is so important and getting basic skills like literacy is so important to participating in democracy and being a citizen in this country, that it is sort of held to a higher standard than maybe some other things might be. So there's this question, again, it's sort of an open question of whether the state in this case, because, you know, these children have to, by law, attend school, whether the state must provide a certain basic level of education that at least enables these kids to have a chance to advance in life.
So they're basically deciding, here's the lowest we can go, here's the floor, or is there a floor, I guess?
Yeah, that is exactly the question. I mean, when you put it that way, it sounds sort of awful. But yeah, that's exactly what's going on here. And the question is what is happening in these five schools in Detroit so bad that it doesn't even constitute a basic, minimally adequate education, which the state argues it has, by the way, it has no obligation to actually provide. And in fact, that the state itself does not provide education, that it's local units of government in Michigan.
What's next in this lawsuit?
Well, the judge heard arguments yesterday, and he sort of took it under advisement and said he would probably rule on the state's motion to dismiss as soon as possible. But because this case is somewhat complicated, it might take a little longer than the usual 30 days. But he made it sound like sometime next month we can expect a decision on whether this will actually go forward to the trial phase.
That is Michigan Radio Sarah Swick. Thanks very much.
Sure. Thank you.
A merchant freighter has run aground downstream from the Soo locks on the St. Mary's River. We are talking with the Coast Guard right now, Lieutenant Junior Grade Sean Murphy of the United States Coast Guard Sector Sault Ste. Marie. So what do we know about this? When did this happen, and is it blocking the lock?
So currently, the vessel that's grounded north of Sugar Island is a motor vessel Calumet. And it ran aground on August 9th, which was Wednesday, at 11:40 p.m., it was transiting downbound on the St. Mary's River after unloading its cargo at Esser Steel in Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, and it was heading to Brevoort, Michigan, when it ran aground.
So do we know why it went aground?
We don't, sir. That's currently still under investigation.
So the locks are shut down?
The waterway from the locks to Six Mile Point is shut down to commercial traffic.
So what happens to the freighters, the cargo ships that are on either side of the lock? Are they blocked now?
So there are 12 vessels that are currently lined up and waiting to go downbound the river.
So they're on the Lake Superior side.
Yep, and then three that are waiting to go upbound. They're anchored out there or moored to a safe pier.
So what's the plan?
Where we stand right now, sir, we're continuing to monitor the situation for any possible environmental impact or pollution, and we haven't seen anything or observed any impact to the environment. We are waiting for the salvage plan from the owner of the vessel. In the salvage plan, we'll include all safety precautions taken. They're going to include their current plan to actually get the vessel off the ground. And they're going to present to us technical data such as vessel stability information as well as structural integrity. Coast Guard will take that information, send it to our salvage experts. They'll review it and make sure that the plan looks safe for the environment and the waterway, at which point we'll either approve it or go back to them and work with the company on the plan and move forward from there. So we're trying to get it done as quick as possible.
That is Lieutenant Junior Grade Sean Murphy of the United States Coast Guard Sector Sault Ste. Marie. Thanks very much for talking with us.
All right. Thank you, sir.
It's time to visit another artisan of Michigan, this time in Ann Arbor. That's the sound of sewing baby carriers. They're called ring sling carriers. But this artisan has gone way beyond making something useful. Here she is.
I'm Bree Abeloff with Hope Carried.
We should mention, we're down in the basement where yeah. you work, and the kids are upstairs running around. When did this idea of Hope Carried start?
So the idea of Hope Carried came long after the product started. The product came about as I had the need and desire to keep my youngest daughter, Josephine, close to me, but didn't want to pay for a new ring sling. So I made one. So a ring sling is a type of baby carrier that uses a kind of belt-like tie through rings, and it goes over one shoulder and holds your baby like on your chest or on your hip.
So it's a sling
yeah.
that actually uses the rings to bind the sleeve, so it's adjustable.
Exactly. It's completely adjustable and creates a customized fit for each person, so it's one size.
Where did this thing come from?
You know, I don't know where they came from because I did not invent them. Unfortunately, I'd be much more successful if I had, but I had seen them. There's other companies that have made them, and, you know, there's patterns on Pinterest. You can find a lot of different ways to make them. So I'm not sure where it probably actually originated, but I found it on Pinterest.
So this is just a matter of you wanted one.
Uh-huh.
They were expensive. You couldn't afford one at the time.
Exactly.
So you thought, I can do that.
Totally. My grandmother had given me this sewing machine and had kind of fixed it up because I thought I would be like one of those moms who made all my kids' clothes. And I made a couple blankets and they were pretty crappy. But I thought, well, I could make a baby carrier. And so my mom came over and we just made it on my like living room floor. And I absolutely loved it. I loved how it felt like I was carrying her, where other baby carriers I had kind of felt like they were hanging from me or tugging on me, and the ring sling really it created like this really comfortable, customizable, easy to adjust type of baby carrier. And I also really loved that I could nurse right in it. I didn't have to take it off, but I could nurse in it and nobody would know. I would nurse in all types of places and not have to like put her down in it, and it was very discreet and nobody around me knew what I was doing, which I think that was like a top selling point for me about the ring sling.
You actually hire people to help you.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about how that came about.
Yeah, so as the demand grew, I was feeling pretty overwhelmed, and I was actually listening to NPR, and they were speaking about a woman who had fled Afghanistan, and she was here looking for work and a safe place to live, but she'd be lucky to find work as a seamstress. And I thought, I should hire her. That would be amazing. So I did. I tried to hire her. I drove out to Detroit. She was at a local asylum shelter. So I went to Detroit and met the woman who they called M and wouldn't let me have her identity at the time. But long story short is she wasn't able to work because she was an asylum seeker and they're not legally authorized to work in the U.S. But one of the men who worked there, his wife was a seamstress, and she was from Togo, Africa, and had sewn in Africa and was really interested. So I ended up meeting them, her name's Sina, and hiring her. And that sort of led me to think, like, I should hire mothers with barriers to employment. And I just specifically wanted to hire mothers because I just had a big heart for what it's like to be a mother and trying to work and navigating childcare and all of those issues, and wanting to provide a way for moms to work without having to pay for childcare. They're able to work at home. They're able to work, you know, hours that work for them, nap time, bedtime, whatever it may be. So I got in touch with a local agency here in Ann Arbor, Jewish Family Services, and just worked with their employment case managers to get paired with women. And we just host open houses there. And I've been able to hire strictly from there this whole time. And like I said, so one of my seamstresses is upstairs with her children. Sometimes they work here, but in the past probably year, we've been able to make sure that they have sewing machines so they're able to work from home whenever they want to.
We went upstairs to talk to that seamstress, Sana. Her husband, Sammy, stopped by during lunch break to translate for us. We're not using their real names because he did work for the U.S. Army in their home country. That could cause problems for their families back home.
What do you think of the work? What does the work mean to you?
So when I got there first, it was hard for me. I was depressed since I started working with home care. So I'm very happy working for home care.
She says she's not a very good seamstress, but you and the other women who are working with her brought up her quality. How does it make you feel?
I'm glad. I'm happy to hear that.
Back down in the basement, Bri Abelov explained during the off season she employs two women, but as they start getting more orders toward the holidays, she's hired as many as six.
You're a new business. How can you afford that?
Well, I have yet to pull a salary or any type of paycheck from Hope Carried up to this point. So I just reinvest all the sales we have right back into the women, because that's really important to me, is even more so than becoming profitable, is being able to, you know, break those barriers for these women and hopefully end the cycle of poverty for them as well.
That's Bri Abelov with Hope Carey, our latest artisan of Michigan. Coming up, Michiganders love their Lake Michigan shoreline, and some are concerned about a proposed development around Saugatuck Dunes. That's after the break. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. There is a stretch of dunes along Lake Michigan that might be under development before too long, and that's got a lot of people concerned, including David Swan. He's the president of Saugatuck Dunes Coastal Alliance. Let's talk about where this is. How close to Saugatuck are the Saugatuck Dunes?
Actually, the original site of Saugatuck, which was named Singapore, is at the mouth of the Kalamazoo River, and the proposed marina would be right over top of the buried ghost town of Singapore. So once the channel was straightened in 1906, many of those houses were moved into Saugatuck, further upriver, away from the river mouth. So it's about 3/4 of a mile.
Just a little closer to the lake than the city actually is today.
Yes, okay. Yes, exactly.
The Saugatuck Dunes are scenic, shifting sands, as dunes are. Why are they important?
The Saugatuck Dunes are to Grand Rapids, as the Marin Headlands are to San Francisco, as the Cape is to Boston, as the Olympic Peninsula and San Juan Islands are to Seattle. They're nearby wilderness to a bustling commercial center, a creative center. And we all know what's happening with Grand Rapids, which is terrific. And I think in large part that's because of the proximity to the lake and areas like the Saugatuck Dunes, which are relatively undeveloped, lightly developed.
So it doesn't sound like you're against economic development or development of property, just how this might be developed.
Exactly. We are not against development. We are absolutely for the economic vision that's laid out in our tri-community master plan. And in Saugatuck, we have Saugatuck, Douglas, and Saugatuck Township. We came together in 2003 and 2004 to put together our economic vision. What do we want our community to look like? The number one priority of our community is to acquire both the north and the south properties at the mouth of the Kalamazoo River. And the red thread winding its way through the master plan is protection of the natural resources, realizing that that's our economic driver. Our geography is our economy.
Let's talk about the area you're concerned about. It was recently changed hands, but the previous owner on that site, how did he wield that kind of negotiating skill? I mean, who is he?
Well, Aubrey McClendon started Chesapeake Energy, a natural gas company, self-proclaimed world's biggest fracker. Fortune magazine named him America's most reckless billionaire. Aubrey owned the land. He owned it for about 10 years. He put forth a proposal for a marina, a 9.5-story tall hotel, as well as about 20 houses. He had the houses on the market for about 3 years and did not sell one single house, or lot, rather. He never pulled the trigger on the permitting process of the marina. I suspect he and his attorneys realized that it was against local zoning and against state and federal law.
So he sold this property, and as of February of this year, it has new owners.
Correct, yes.
Who are they?
Jeff and Peg Padnos of Holland, philanthropists, community-minded, but they are from Holland rather than Saugatuck. And they're essentially McClendon 2.0. They are putting forth a similar marina resort proposal to what McClendon proposed.
What's wrong with a resort in this area or a marina in this area? I mean, those always sound like things that people could enjoy, that it might be attractive to other people coming into Saugatuck, helping it. You know, it's got a reputation of kind of an artist area. It might
Absolutely.
Be the kind of people you draw in.
Certainly. So Saugatuck has a number of marinas. We have, I think, 1,200 boat slips in Saugatuck Harbor. Right now we're at about 80% capacity. There's not a need for 50 more slips, especially that close to the lake. It's better economically to bring those boaters into the city so they can dock, and then they can walk and get ice cream, they can catch a meal, they can have a craft beer, they can go shopping.
Well, marine is not the only thing they're planning here, though, right? I mean,
They're also planning houses. If you look at a map and you look north of the proposed marina, it's Saugatuck Dunes State Park. The state invested quite a bit of money to protect that. And the part of the park immediately adjacent to the proposed marina resort is designated natural area, the Patricia Burkholz Natural Area. Across the river to the south is the $20 million Saugatuck Harbor Natural Area. Locals invested $20 million to protect that from the very type of development the Padnoses are proposing. It is inappropriate to put in such a large development nearly enclosed by publicly funded natural areas. It would be much better if the Padnoses, if they wanted to put in a marina resort, they put it in downtown Saugatuck or Douglas. Tower Marine is actually for sale, which would be appropriate for this kind of development that they're proposing. It's just not appropriate, and it's against local zoning, and it's against state law.
So where is this in the process? They have this idea. They have this project. We're talking about 15 houses and this marina, 50-slip marina, and there's already a structure there, a house there. So where are they in the process of getting this approved?
They put forth a plan to the Saugatuck Township Planning Commission. It received preliminary conditional approval. There are about 25 conditions that they have to meet, including getting a permit from the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality and the Army Corps of Engineers to dredge 160,000 to 200,000 tons of sand to put in the boat basin. Now, to put that into context, state law requires a sand dune mining permit when you dredge 3,000 tons. So again, 3,000 tons triggers the requirement for a sand dune mining permit, and they're looking at about 160,000 to 200,000 tons of sand. So they have not yet applied for the marina permit. They just submitted a final plan to the Saugatuck Township Planning Commission. The Coastal Alliance has appealed to Allegan Circuit Court the preliminary approval. When a planning commission approves or denies, they have to have findings of fact. They have to write why they made the decision they did. They did not include that, which is very basic. Every single solitary approval or denial requires that, and they did not have that.
What do you want to happen here?
There is a way to balance development with a conservation design and community values. I think there can be a win-win for everybody.
But does this include no development, no further development on this property at all in your mind? Or are you talking about moving it somewhere else, as you said, in downtown Douglas or downtown Saugatuck? Or can something be done on this property that you would find acceptable?
The preference of many people over the course of the last six decades has been to preserve this entire property because of the historic site of the buried ghost town of Singapore, the globally imperiled interdunal wetlands, the economic significance of the view sheds. However, we do recognize that it's privately held and there can be some development. And again, I think balancing community values with the developer's need for return on investment, I think there could be a scaling back of the proposed marina and properly place the houses so that they don't interrupt the rather expensive view shed that locals have invested in, the $20 million Saugatuck Harbor Natural Area.
That is David Swan. He's president of the Saugatuck Dunes Coastal Alliance. Thanks very much for talking with
us. Oh, thank you very much.
We thought it would be a good idea to go to this property and talk with the developer, Brian Boscroff, and owner Jeff Padnos. Standing next to the channel where the marina would start, Boscroff explained the plan.
Our property is this 300-plus acres here that goes all the way from Blue Star Highway out to Lake Michigan. And our northern neighbors are the Saugatuck Dune Natural Area, which is part of the state park, and then the private property of the Saugatuck Dune Ride. And then the camp property here on the river. So when we first looked at purchasing the property, there was a tremendous amount of information in the file because there was some other development efforts. And there was a lot of creative designs and a lot of due diligence that the other team had done. So immediately we had all these sort of natural features reports to these topographical surveys, a lot of information. So when we first looked at it, we were able to basically identify all the areas that we should just kind of stay out of.
By that you mean preserve?
Preserve. So we were able to kind of outline the areas that were more the open moving dune areas here to the north, adjacent to the state natural area. And then in this area, the 50 acres approximately closer to the lake is where there's some interdunal wetlands and some other really nice features. So we identified those. We took them off the essentially right out of the equation, and we tried to make sure it could work financially to work just on the lake and channel.
So you've got, 15 different house sites, it looks like, and then a central beach house.
That's the house that was built 30 years ago by one of the former owners of the property, Ken Dennison. So that's kind of the iconic house that's been there for 30 years.
And then you've got this marina, which I guess is the greatest concern to the Coastal Alliance, the idea that you're going to be dredging and expanding what's already here.
Well, exactly. So there was a building that was over 500 feet long by several hundred feet wide. And that's this area here, and that's essentially where the basin would come in, where it is no wetlands, there are no steep slopes, there is no conflict with any of the critical dune statutes, essentially creating this new water habitat on a sense of a regulatory sense is actually a net positive. As we're moving through the application, there isn't anything in the application that is against any particular ordinance or code or law.
Can you understand why they might be concerned about that, though?
I can understand their passion, but I don't understand some of the other stuff, I guess. Maybe Jeff can speak to that a bit. But the when I met with a representative from the Coastal Dune Alliance, their concern was traffic congestion. And that was their only concern at the time. And I think the Coast Guard can assess whether that's a factual statement or not, or concern.
Well, I turn to you, because this is your brainchild to begin with. Tell me about what interested you in the property, and when did you acquire it?
We acquired it, actually. We signed papers in November, and we closed in January. And we were aware, everybody that lives around here was aware, that this area has been a subject of a lot of attention for many, many years. And
potential development.
And potential development. There were plans for extensive development under the previous owner, a golf course, riding trails, a hotel, condominiums, individual home sites, very, very extensive. And then when he died, basically the estate decided to sell it, and it struck me as an opportunity to resolve these controversies and to try to be as responsive to as many of the different voices in the area as we could. We don't know for certain, as a buyer, the seller doesn't necessarily tell you all his options, but according to what they told us, the only other bidders that they were seriously considered were more traditional developers from outside the area. And we perceived that we could come up with a way to develop it and still be very responsive to the voices of the community. There isn't just one voice in this community. There are many.
Right. We've heard from the environmentalists, the Coastal Alliance, but I understand that some of the folks in Saugatuck are enthusiastic about development because it means, you know, prosperity for their town. But what about these things that the environmental folks are worried about, like this expanded marina, about the dunes that are here, about the fact that it's surrounded by public lands?
Well, that's just it. A lot of the people are noticing that it is surrounded by public lands, and there's, you know, there is a lot of public land already. And what we intend to do is actually create even more than half. If things go well on this, we intend to preserve more than half of what we acquire as additional public lands. And the question is whether you...
Now you say public lands. Do you mean preserved for the private folks?
Okay. No, not necessarily preserved. We have to work that out exactly how that's going to be. Now, preserved, we are already at work, for example, with the Outdoor Discovery Center and they're studying this summer, coming up with a potential project list for creating sites for them to use in their nature school curriculum, because they've got such a demand for their services. They have a school that they started, but a lot of the other schools want to take advantage of what they've developed, and they need more sites. So we've invited them to come in here and do that. Our intention is truly to make this into a community asset. There'll be parts of it that are privately owned, but I can tell you in the last 3 months there have been more people on site than there had been in the previous 10 years, probably more. The other thing that's attractive is that, particularly in this boat basin area, we've got a lot of interest from people who live here that would like to make this their 12-month residence. So it wouldn't just be some, you know, out-of-town owned. We want it could very much be a community of people that would live here.
At the prices I was looking at, I'm not sure how many people are going to be able to afford that.
That's, there's no question that it's high-income people, but we aren't selling it based on being cut off from the community.
The thing that maybe we'll have a chance today, I'd love to get you out onto the property and show you the variety of landscapes that exist here. I mean, there are outstanding natural features. There are beautiful open dunes.
So we hopped in the truck, looked at the housing sites closer to the shore, and we got in an off-road vehicle to see the more sensitive spots such as the shifting dunes, wetlands, and so forth. Old signs marking housing sites where the previous owner wanted to develop give you a clear idea just how much development is being scaled back to preserve the environmentally sensitive areas. At one point, we stopped at the far end of where the planned marina would be.
This basin, 200 feet wide, 1,500 feet long.
Yep.
We're looking at the property right now, but you're not worried about the impact.
Well, as you can see, it is an area that there are no steep slopes. There is no wetland. It previously had kind of a planted plantation of a non-native invasive tree, the Austrian pine, which has been removed already. Every tree that we would have to cut down has to be replaced with another tree as a condition of the permit.
Jeff Padnos, with existing opposition to previous development plans, why take on something that could be a headache?
Well, people have asked that, and that's a good question. I saw an opportunity to do a good thing. This it has a potential to be a legacy type project. Something. I mean, I acknowledge that I look at it that way. Something that when we're done, we're very proud of what we've done, and that the vast majority of people will see it. There's differing viewpoints, and what we've tried to do is find a marriage of those two to find here this area meets this viewpoint, and so we can do this here, and this area over here meets that viewpoint, and we can do that here, and we can actually accommodate a lot of people if given the opportunity. And I really believe we do, because I'm fortunate that I don't have to squeeze every last piece of housing site out of this investment. It can be done in a balanced way, and I think that Brian and his team have done a phenomenal job of doing that.
That's owner Jeff Padnos, and we heard from Brian Boscroff, the developer of the marina and housing sites on this area of the Saugatuck Dunes. We'll keep an eye on this to see how the community and the developers work through their differences. Coming up, how many neighborhoods, school districts, and cities became so segregated in Michigan. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The legacy of discrimination of people of color and discrimination of certain religions affects the cities we see today. To explain how and why that's the case, Bridge Magazine's Mike Wilkinson reported on the issue and then, being the data expert he is, put together 9 interactive maps of Michigan cities to show how discrimination of the past impacts housing patterns today. Mike, welcome back.
Hi, how are you doing?
Just fine. You used maps and documents from the government's Homeowners Loan Corporation, an FDR New Deal agency created in the 1930s. What did that agency do?
Well, back at the height of the New Deal, coming out of the Depression, a lot of homeowners had their homes foreclosed. They couldn't make their payments, and they were losing them, millions across the nation. And so the Homeowners Loan Corp was created to give lenders and the mortgage holders themselves a break. They were buying the bad loans, and they were extending the terms and giving people a chance to get out from underneath the foreclosures. So that was one piece of what was going on at the time. And right about the same time, the Federal Housing Administration was created. And together, these two agencies adopted what many would today would think is crazy, the sociology of the time, which called for exclusion of the races, to separate them, to have all white neighborhoods or mostly black neighborhoods, and even to keep the foreign born away from the longer term Americans, for lack of a better word. This is rooted in government policy that you find in these maps from the late 1930s and in the language of the FHA, which ultimately ended up bankrolling the explosion of the suburbs.
So what kind of language did these agencies use when they were describing these neighborhoods where people of color lived or foreign born?
What they were basically trying to do was create a risk assessment for these areas. You know, today, when you go and borrow money, the risk assessment is based upon your income, your credit rating, the job you have, how long have you had that job. It's not based on whether or not you're black, white, Hispanic, whether you're Jewish or foreign born. But back then, there was this school of thought by some of the best academics in the nation at the time, people who were at the University of Chicago, the University of Michigan, that felt you could gauge a neighborhood's risk by whether there were those elements, the undesirables. And this is the language you're asking about. On the sheets where the appraisers went through and judged a neighborhood, they wanted to know what kind of inhabitants they were. They wanted to know if there was infiltration. And often after that line is words like infiltration, colon, Jews and Negroes, Greeks and Syrians, the foreign-born, Italians, Poles. But there was a special section that they wanted to know for every area, were there Negroes there? And what you find is wherever that was yes, almost entirely in Michigan in the nine cities. Those areas were redlined. And in Grand Rapids, there's
Explain redline to us.
Well, so they had four different levels. You had the green area, which was considered desirable. You had blue, which was still considered good, but yet not at its peak. You had yellow, which was a little bit of a warning area, and you had red. These areas were areas of higher risk for residential lending. And in Michigan, you know, all the areas that were red weren't just where blacks were, but conversely, where blacks were, almost universally, except for two places in the entire state, were red, and those two were still considered yellow, which had a heightened risk. So that's where the term redlining is. You had these neighborhoods that were deemed higher risk, and then when the FHA comes in just after that and begins a different kind of lending, the Homeowners Loan Corporation was basically picking up failed loans. The FHA was issuing new loans over longer periods of term, but they pick up the same language, the same sociology, where the goal was keep the races separate, keep people of different demographic backgrounds separate, and then we'll all be better off. At least that was the thinking at the time.
And so I guess banks and real estate agents reacted to these government findings?
This is not the first time that the African American in the United States faced discrimination. Forever, they were discriminated by landlords, by real estate agents, by home sellers. What this did and what experts say, it codified it. It made it the rule of law. And so when banks in subsequent years would redline, they were just doing what the government. They had it had the imprimatur of officialdom, and it allowed it to continue up until the late 60s, where you had the civil rights movement remove a lot of these housing restrictions that had been in place for almost 30 years.
What can we learn from the nine interactive maps you put together of these cities in Michigan?
If you go to them, and you can see them at bridgemi.com, you can go look at Detroit, and you can see those parts of the city that were where the blacks were, where the green and the white were, where the green, the very good areas were. And quite often, it's not one-to-one, because obviously the city of Detroit is now majority black. It's not like they were just relegated to stay in one particular area, but you see the echoes and the hints in Bay City or in Saginaw or in Flint, where the African-American community was 80 years ago, that's largely where they are now because they were restricted from getting a loan in those other suburbs at the time. You know, in Flint, the black community, I mean, it is a majority black town, but the highest concentration is to the north. The areas where there were fewer blacks, you know, 80 years ago or none, still have fewer now. Because at the time, the banks and the FHA wouldn't insure loans for them to move into an area what would be considered racially disharmonious. So it kind of locked in some of the housing patterns that we see today. And I think it's relevant looking at, you know, here we are 50 years after the riot and the rebellion of 67. A large part of the anger that existed obviously was because of the police issues, but a lot of it also was the housing patterns. The 43 riots, a lot of it was the housing where you had the segregation where the African American community was locked into small parts of the city and was excluded from others, and especially ultimately the suburbs, where it was very hard for them to break into those housing markets, at least with the backing of a federal loan.
And just a note, Mike put together maps for Battle Creek, Bay City, Detroit, Grand Rapids, Flint, Kalamazoo, Muskegon, Pontiac, and Saginaw. Sounds like a lot of work. So if you're interested in your town, you can probably find it. So where did you get all this information, and how did you design these interactive maps?
Well, I took advantage of the great work done by a consortium of researchers from Virginia Tech, the University of Richmond, and a couple other institutions, which took these old 1937 maps, which were just static paper maps, and they've laid them over current geography and allowed you to click on neighborhoods and then see what were the appraisers saying about them. It's an incredibly rich data set that allows you to go wherever. I mean, even if you don't live in Michigan, let's say you live in, you know, Columbus, Ohio, or Chicago, you can look at the maps there. It's fantastic work from people who really take serious cartography and making sure that history can come alive so that it's not just a piece of paper. You can actually connect and see what were they saying? Were there undesirables in your neighborhood? Was your neighborhood lauded because it restricted blacks from it? They allow you to see this and just play around and just go neighborhood to neighborhood, and it's just fantastic stuff that allows everyone today to see there really is a basis to white privilege.
Now, just understanding how racism of the past causes issues today is a start, but are there solutions on how to deal with that legacy?
That's one of the problems that we have today. I mean, there have been a lot of places that have tried to take affirmative steps to, you know, lessen the impact. You have Shaker Heights, Ohio. You have Oak Park, Illinois. But they still run into the legacy of 80 years. I mean, you had these mortgages, which are 30-year mortgages, some were 20 years. And so you've locked in patterns that are harder to unlock. We've created a society in many cases where we've never known if we could live together because we've lived apart for so long. I don't have a magic bullet answer to this. And if you have one and your readers have one, I'd love to hear it. But it's a problem that's going to take a lot longer to solve than it probably took to create.
Mike Wilkinson is a reporter for Bridge Magazine, one of our Detroit Journalism Cooperative partners, and you can find his story at bridgemi.com. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to someone who's been researching this issue for decades. Joe T. Darden is an author and a professor of geography at Michigan State University. Let's start with the main theme of this article by Mike Wilkinson. How can discriminatory practices in the 1930s and after actually have an impact on cities today?
Well, they have an impact because the reason that the situation existed back in the 1930s still exists today in this sense. Whenever we talk about the issue of discrimination, we have to look at it first from the ideology of white supremacy, which is deeply ingrained in white American culture in the United States. And so as long as that ideology exists, and there are those who wish to implement that ideology, you get discrimination as a result of that. So what you have is a situation in which, among most of the white population in the United States, there is the ideology of white supremacy in which some of them hold, and the ideology of democracy in which others hold. These two conflicting ideologies have always been a part of American history. And when one is more powerful than the other, you get discrimination in housing, education, employment, and other aspects of life. When the democracy ideology is more powerful, you get a situation of integration, equal opportunity, and equal racial situations. That is what has happened throughout American history. It still exists down to the present day.
I want to talk about that a little further, but I want to pursue this housing thing. For most families, most of their wealth is wrapped up in home ownership. The house or the proceeds from that house are passed from generation to generation. Why have many families of color often been unable to gain in that scenario?
Well, they're unable to gain in it for the very reason I mentioned. Throughout American history, the institutions that control housing, home ownership, for example, have been in the hands of the mortgage lenders, real estate brokers, and they have been those who have wanted to separate neighborhoods by race and inequality. And they've always done that. They have profited from it, and they have advocated the situation that most white residents do not want to live in the same neighborhoods where blacks reside. And so to carry out the wishes of their particular white population, they have been engaged in aspects of discrimination housing, and they can still do that down to the present day, in fact.
Right. We hear from the Fair Housing Centers in Michigan. They've revealed incidents of discrimination on an all too frequent basis. I don't think a lot of people are aware of that. When you teach your students, how aware are they of ongoing discrimination?
Well, some are aware and some are not. It's always a continuum, and it depends on the life experiences of most of the students. Now, most of the students I teach are white, and most reside in suburban areas as opposed to residing in cities. Those that had some exposure in residential neighborhoods that were integrated are a bit more open to the fact that discrimination housing exists. Those who live in the suburbs and have been isolated, they do not have any understanding that the situation exists. They don't understand why they're able to reside in the suburbs and the cities are disproportionately black and Latino.
After redlining ostensibly ended and middle-class African-Americans followed whites moving to the suburbs, we saw housing values in central cities plummet. That means family wealth evaporates for many people of color. How long-lasting is that loss for a family?
Well, it's a loss that they probably do not get over for generations because intergenerational transfer of wealth exists primarily through home ownership, in which a family owned the home, and when they pass on, they hand that home on to their offspring, their children, who benefit from it because they're able to have a house immediately when they become an adult because they essentially inherit the house from their family, their parents. Now, what happened is that years ago, African-Americans did not have the same opportunity. The federal government discriminated against African-Americans in terms of home ownership.
They provided opportunity to whites by guaranteeing their mortgage in case it defaulted. They would pay the mortgage, so the banks were ready to lend them money openly without regard to their credit ratings. But they would do that if they would move to the suburbs, where they were essentially more secure in terms of the risk they would take. African Americans could not move to the suburbs because of discrimination housing by landlords, landladies, and real estate brokers. And so that resulted in lower rates of home ownership and lower value of the housing that they could buy. And so they never really gained equality of opportunity when it came to home ownership. And even down to the present day, the home ownership rate of African Americans is less than that of the white population.
In the suburbs, especially the inner ring suburbs, we're seeing segregation just as distinctly as segregation was in the big cities. Why is that happening?
Well, it is happening because the mobility of whites out from the city has been a continuous pattern of moving further and further out. And they've done that. The first location in the suburbs of the whites, they were primarily members from the white ethnic groups, and they settled in the inner suburbs. That was their way to escape the cities, and they could afford their homes there, and that's where they located. Over time, as the people in the city moved to the inner suburbs, they moved further out to the outer suburbs. And they continued that pattern of spatial mobility outwards over time. And so what you have now is that the highest home ownership rates exist in the outer suburbs. The highest quality of housing exists there. The highest quality schools exist there. So that has been a continuous pattern over time. It continues to exist and will probably continue for a long time to come.
When you poll white folks and black folks, each of them say they'd just as soon live near someone of their own color. So I'm wondering, how much is segregation we see in cities such as Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland, how much is that chiefly due to self-segregation?
Well, my research doesn't support that argument that all racial groups behave the same way when it comes to preferences to live within one's own group. My research suggests that the only group that has been consistently preferring to live among their own group has been the white population. Among the black population, that is not the case. Among the Latino population, that is not the case. And is also not the case among the Asian American population. And the only group that wants white-only neighborhoods, essentially the white population. The other groups are open to a diverse type of neighborhood, but what they want, and this is a consistent desire among all of them, they want a home at a good value. They want a neighborhood that's high quality. They want a neighborhood with high achieving schools. Now, that is a consistent preference regardless of race, but the other groups can't get that unless they integrate. And so in a sense, that they're motivated by integrating with white population because they can't get that high quality neighborhood, high quality schools, unless they do so.
Among many white folks, there's the belief that discrimination and racism are a thing of the past. We just need to move on. But when you've had generations of systematic racism, how difficult is it for families, people of color, to just move on?
Well, they probably would have been open to just moving on if the situation had ended when we got things like the Fair Housing Act of 1968, when you got the legislation that addressed the issue to some extent. But that has not happened. In other words, what existed years ago continued to exist down to the present day. Only one generation after the other, they continue to carry on those same ideas. And so we haven't really addressed it because the ideology of white supremacy persists. And if it ended when the legislation existed, such as the Fair Housing Act, blacks and others may say, let's move on. But you can't move on when you still have the situation happening again.
The data are there. The research is available. Why, among policymakers, is this inequality largely ignored?
Well, again, a lot of the policymakers still remain white, and their constituents remain white. And so as long as you have that divide by race among the voters, you will get a situation in which the white voters essentially support politicians who support their ideas. And if they hold the ideology of white supremacy, they want a politician to represent that. And that's what you get. And you have that now in the present-day situation. You get it because policymakers are rigidly divided by race and ideology. And that situation continues.
Joe T. Darden is a professor of geography at Michigan State University. Hey, thanks. It was nice to talk to you again.
You're quite welcome.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Rusty Brock. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Ali Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Petulano Ali, Jacob Meschke, and Tyler Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.